So, about 40 years ago, I went to live in India while I studied how Western-style psychiatry adapts to a foreign cultural setting. I'd been there only a couple of months when I wrote my PhD advisor, the late Margaret Clark, a frantic letter. "Dear Margaret, anthropology is impossible. You can't figure out what's causing anything because everything is caused by everything else. Medicine, religion, family structure, history, environment, power relations, it's all tangled up in one big impenetrable mess. What should I do?" After a week or so, I got back a reply. "Dear Michael, it sounds like you are doing just fine. Keep up the good work." Apparently, I had mastered at least one lesson: culture is complicated. When the Unitarian Universalist General Assembly decided to place love at the very center of UU values, it got me wondering about what that meant, since love is, of course, one of the most amorphous words in our language, and about whether there are limits to how far love can reach. I am one of those people who knows a little bit about a lot of things. And you know what they say about a little knowledge. Heedless of the danger, though, I decided to try in this reflection to draw upon topics not typically considered together, including zoology, prehistory, and the history of religion, to imagine how the reach of love may have changed over time. I'm calling it a just-so story about love. By that, I don't mean the kind of fanciful just-so story that Rudyard Kipling told about how the camel got his hump, but a tale so simplified, so stripped of complications, exceptions, and qualifications that it can't actually be true. I hope, however, that as Claude Levi-Strauss said about folk tales in general, my story may be good to think with. I chose this reflection because whenever I've asked myself big questions, I've found there are always, always other people asking the same questions. Next month, I'll be returning to India with my son, who will be making his first visit. I'm concerned about how he will react to some of the things he will experience there. In India, where the wealth held by the nation's wealthiest 1% is even more concentrated than in the US, the poverty is hard to ignore. At hotels and tourist sites in India, we are likely to be swarmed by dozens of beggars, some of them missing limbs, others carrying babies. I will have to tell my son that there are ways to contribute to the betterment of the beggars' lives, but that 80% of every rupee given directly to them will go into the pockets of the gangsters who organize them. He will still want to give, of course, faced with such misery, who wouldn't? And he may even hate me a little bit for having told him that. But it will also remind me of hard questions I ask myself. How much is enough? Should I use my modest treasure to make my own children's lives better, or should I use it to help people I will never meet? How much of my short life should go to efforts that will make a difference only if a million others are making the same effort? In my Just So story, some of the roots of love go back to before there were humans. Like monkeys and apes, humans are primates. And primates share certain characteristics. Nearly all primates live in groups, form affectional bonds with others in the group, and can distinguish individual members of their own group from individuals who are not. Within their group, they compete for status, which gives easier access to food, preferred space, and sexual partners. Both males and females compete. Learning is critical for all primates. We have to learn things to survive. The main ways we learn are through imitation, repetition, practice, if you will, and habit formation. And all primates can feel empathy. Some psychologists think empathy, an ability to sense what others are feeling, should be separated from mentalization, an ability to imagine what others are thinking. If so, primates can do both. So can dogs and cats to varied extents. So can dolphins and whales. I wouldn't be surprised if dolphins are actually better at empathy than humans, but given all the space our brains devote to imagining possibilities that might or might not happen, humans probably mentalize the most. But it was with empathy, I believe, that our primate ancestors were already laying a foundation for love. For most of the roughly 300,000 years that modern-looking humans have walked the Earth, we lived in extended family groups, tight-knit bands of maybe 10 to 30, some of which moved about within a geographical range, others of which traveled far away from their places of origin. The few foraging cultures still around in the early 20th century were all basically egalitarian, albeit respecting those with greater knowledge or skill. They carried few individual possessions. They shared whatever food they found. At times, several bands would temporarily camp near each other, so young men and women of reproductive age did often find partners and get adopted into a different band. What counts as family across cultures takes many forms. Other types of allegiances often cross-cut the influence of family, and catastrophic occurrences do sometimes break families apart. In general, though, family bonds have remained the strongest and most demanding of affiliations. It should surprise no one that during the 2 years my birth mother was dying of cancer when I was not yet 10, my mother's sister, my father's sister, my mother's mother, my father's mother, my mother's aunt, and my mother's cousin all came from different parts of the country to live with us for months, taking turns nursing my mother and caring for her children. All women. This was the start of the 1960s. An anthropologist from India, Harold Gould, who studied small villages in his home province, declared that in those villages, one's obligation to one's family was theoretically unlimited. You gave them money if they needed it, fed and clothed them if they needed that. If their life was in danger, you would risk your own life to save theirs. But no one in Gould's villages thought such obligations extended to anyone outside their family. Could be a little misleading. On my first visit to India, I met a 12-year-old boy who liked to hang out near the small hotel where I was staying. He offered to show me around the neighborhood, and while doing so, he introduced me to the many relatives we came across, his sister, uncle, grandfather. But after he'd introduced four or five different men as his grandfather, I asked him, "Muni, how many grandfathers do you have?" He laughed, and he said they weren't really his grandfathers, but they acted like grandfathers to him. The model of love offered by family turns out to be flexible enough to expand to others. There came a period late in the Neolithic when some families must have started to roam around together, following or hunting herds of hoofed game, while others stayed in one place with a number of families settling close to one another in the best places. Not having to carry around everything you owned with you made it possible to accumulate more possessions and to amass wealth. And in time, some families acquired more wealth than others. Wealthier families gained status. A family with a high enough status might even claim for the head of that family the authority to make decisions for the entire village, leading to hereditary chiefs. Neighboring chiefdoms sometimes got into disputes and even fought each other, and loyalty expanded beyond family to include one's whole community. Villages grew into towns, towns into cities, cities into empires. People started to think of themselves as part of a people, a state, a nation. It's obvious humans do have a strong affinity for identifying with a larger group, Otherwise, why would so many people in Wisconsin care so much about the fortunes of mercenaries hired to represent the city of Green Bay? My own path from Unitarian Sunday School to becoming an anthropologist took me across the bridge of comparative religion. Like many others, I was and still am fascinated by the developments in religion during the historical epoch that included the 6th and 5th centuries BC, when an impressive number of influential prophets, philosophers, and founders of religion inhabited different parts of the earth at nearly the same time. Philosopher Carl Jaspers called this the Axial Age. The Buddha was starting a new religion at the same time the Upanishads were inscribing the core beliefs of Hinduism. Confucius and Lao Tzu not only coexisted but actually met each other. Greek culture reached what is called its golden age, and Socrates invented moral philosophy. Nehemiah built the second temple of Judaism, while Ezra organized the Old Testament and is believed by many to be the one who wrote down the Torah. How could these widely separated visionaries have arisen in the same period? These teachers, as I will call them, had very different cosmologies, since each retained many beliefs of the culture or religion from which they'd sprung. But their ethics, many have noted, had striking similarities. Though Hinduism did embrace hierarchy, and Confucius assumed it, all the others were egalitarian, asserting that no person's intrinsic worth was greater than anyone else's. This egalitarianism also showed up a few centuries earlier in the teachings of Zarathustra in Iran, then centuries later in the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth and those of the prophet Muhammad. As empires expanded, more people started writing down oral traditions. Trade was also increasing. Long distance trade between elites had existed for centuries, but it was basically barter. I send you a caravan of things that you want, you send me back a caravan of things that I want. By the 6th and 5th centuries, however, every empire had started minting coins. That meant small traders traveling from town to town could buy something for coins in one town and sell it for coins in another. But how might this have looked to the vast majority who lived on farms or in villages? A farmer might have previously known every person they saw. Even in central marketplaces, they traded with families they traded with before. Now they would often be running into people they'd never seen before. It was even worse in the cities, where people from different parts of an empire had to mix, surrounded by others who might not even speak their own dialect. When I read the writings of Taoism or Judaism or Plato or Aristotle, the heirs of Socrates, or I try to interpret the Jataki tales of Buddhism or the parables of Jesus, certain precepts keep coming up. The best known is the one I learned as do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But two others caught my attention. One could be phrased as give help to the people who most need help. The other as forgive the past wrongs done to you. Why these particular lessons at this time? Perhaps when people knew everyone else in their village, it was sufficient to say, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house, nor his servants, nor his ox. But what about people who weren't your neighbors, or those who might not even belong to what you saw as your own kind? I think the great teachers recognized love had to expand to people one didn't know well or didn't know at all. It had to include every person one met. Everybody is your neighbor, they said. And though there have been times organized religion has, let us say, disappointed us, the precepts of those wise teachers are still worth following. They did good. It was what they needed, what was needed in the times and places they lived. This ends my just-so story, but it leaves an unsolved problem in my mind, indeed the very problem that inspired this reflection. What do we do when it is no longer enough to love every person we meet? We live in a world dramatically different from the world of the Axial Age. Modern communication has shown us that what happens in one place can have profound effects on people in distant lands. Not just our actions, but our failures to act can have implications for others. We have to now find some way to expand our beloved community to include not just everyone we meet, but people we will never meet who live on the other side of the world. Love may also need to include people who aren't even alive yet, who might not be born for 1,000 years. It is quite plausible, maybe by this point even inevitable, that people 1,000 years from now will be suffering from changes to the global climate that people alive today might have prevented. I like to think the great teachers of previous centuries, were they with us now, would adjust their teachings to take into account the challenges love must now rise to meet. I can feel empathy for suffering people when I can see them and hear them. It is harder to summon the same level of emotion for those who are invisible to me, like the people of Western Sudan. I can choose by myself to not kill, but I can't keep others from killing. I might manage to help one person or one family, but I can't reduce poverty in India. I can manage to not covet my neighbor's ox, but I can't keep nations from coveting their neighbor's land. I can try by myself to lighten my environmental footprint, but I can't convince everybody else to give up some comforts and convenience for the greater good. To do the things we can't do by ourselves, love has to expand to include a kind of love that can only be expressed in the first person plural, we. That kind of love has to be a commitment made by a whole community, indeed by a bunch of communities, who can then join forces to pursue our shared dreams. Each of us has our own stuff to deal with, of course, and some of it is very stressful. My belief is that we're no good to anyone else if we don't put that stuff first, along with our inner circles of love and empathy for those closest to us. But I hope that as Unitarian Universalists, we never lose sight of our shared commitment to expand the reach of love. In the words of a more recent teacher, Mahatma Gandhi, the day the power of love overrules the love of power, the world will know peace. That is the kind of love I now envision filling the center of our Unitarian Universalist values. I hope there are others who see it the same way. May it be so.